When you do a write-in, are there two lines actually? Because
Yeah.
I've never done a write-in.
Yeah, because I believe you can still vote for president and vice president.
Because
You can
isn't it
vote.
usually one ticket?
Yes, yeah. So you have to like complete your it's like a fantasy ticket. It's like fantasy football is the best way to think about voting right in. So like who are your starters? Who do you want starting at the line? Who are your wide receivers?
Which is, of course, one of your municipally elected officials, your dog catcher and everything like that. Who's your dream team, though? I would vote for RFK for my dog catcher. He seems to be really good at shit like that. So.
There
Sorry,
you go. Yeah, that's some good material to start with. No,
There we go.
I think like this has been a really weird time in politics the last, whatever, 5 weeks, 4 weeks since the election. I feel like we've been processing it in similar ways, in the sense of like it's kind of this eerie, we've been here before. It's surreal in that it's 8 years later. This pretty much the same outcome, like a similar kind of election between, a centrist Democrat woman against Trump, like largely running a centrist campaign, running up against all of these structural forces that kind of make it hard for that combination of candidates and arguments to come out in the Democrats' favor. And I mean, for me, it was just sort of a feeling of like, oh shit, here we go again. Watching those results come in, watching, Pennsylvania is going in the wrong direction, and then that's it.
Yeah.
It was so bleak.
No, it definitely was. It was the kind of thing where I didn't want to stay up in the evening. I mean, I certainly didn't know which direction it was going to go, and I'm the last person that anybody should ask about, predicting these things, but yeah, I also had that kind of like eerie feeling in the pit of my stomach that we've been here before. And a lot of it was just because the and it's not just because of the way the campaign sounded, but the way that they were responding to similar kinds of conditions that the Clinton campaign was also responding to, the kinds of policy, like real policy positions or lack thereof, that they were putting forward in response to people's, felt precarity in a moment where, prices for things are really high and it feels like it's expensive and dangerous to live in America. If you don't, if you fall underneath a certain line, there's this feeling that it'll be so hard to claw your way back up, and that, in the absence of somebody progressive who's actually giving you real things to latch on to, the only thing that people seem to have was, well, I'm gonna vote for the person who had a good TV show. And, I mean, we'll get into more of the messaging stuff later, but that was kind of my general feeling going into the election, was like this eerie feeling of, yeah, we've been here before. And, it's like, yeah, the ending of Twin Peaks, The Return. What year is it?
What year is this?
Dude. So true. I mean, no, like we'll put a bow on this in a second, but just to say a few more things about how I felt going in, because I think I felt going in, this could go either way, but I was kind of expecting Harris to win. And I think my reason for that was actually quite similar to 2016 and 2020, where I think I underestimated Trump both times, that he, in my opinion, does not run good campaigns. He runs really shitty campaigns. And like he phones it in. I mean, he doesn't seem to care at all about winning at a
It's
lot of
true.
times, and this comes back to a theme that we've talked about a lot on this show. Like a lot of the political events that we've been confronting since we started this show really raise the question of how important it is to be effective at rhetoric.
Yeah.
So much ineffective rhetoric has incredible power because of structural forces that like bias the public sphere towards certain kinds of powerful ideologies and powerful actors and material forces. And so like when Trump had that horrific Madison Square Garden rally,
right,
like a week before the election, I was like, this is it. I mean, he just sunk his campaign.
Yeah.
Like, this is going to push Harris across the finish line. Like, he sent out a comedian who shit on all Puerto Ricans.
There's a lot going on. Like, I don't know if you guys know this, but there's literally a floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. Yeah. I think it's called Puerto Rico.
And he still won. I mean, and so I think like that was the feeling that felt really eerily familiar for me across all three elections, but especially 16 and this one, was like he ran a terrible campaign, but the Democrats ran an even more terrible campaign. And it's just like, I don't know where you go from there. It's just incredibly bleak.
Yeah. I mean, if nothing else, it kind of changes the aperture with which you apply rhetorical analysis, right? Rhetoric is not just what you say, but also what you're responding to and the contextual milieu that you're saying it within. And I think that, you know, just not to oversimplify it as like who knew how to read a room better, but I mean, in some cases there was a little bit of that. And I mean, the question really here is, when the room is on fire, how do you read that room? You know, when things are like the material conditions for so many people are becoming increasingly bleak in this country, do you listen to the rhetoric of the person who is, you know, saying, well, our previous record, you know, kind of speaks for itself. And, you know, we're going to sort of, by the way, here's a random Republican that we're running with for some reason. And, you know, saying all these things that just doesn't quite sound like you mean it. And then there's somebody who's telling jokes, right? Like, at least that person's making you laugh. I don't know. I don't want to be too glib about it here, but I think that there are ways to read, you know, to at least salvage a rhetorical critique out of this by showing that, you know, it's not just what you say. It's when, where, and how you say it.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And I don't mean to like downplay the importance of rhetoric, but more just, you know, this is another one of these outcomes where we see someone rewarded for rhetoric that's very ineffective and like very ham-fisted and seemingly a really chaotic strategy of aligning with these bizarre like online figures of the right. We'll get into this more in a little bit, but I really don't think that the reason Trump won is all of these unorthodox choices of like aligning with the fever swamps of the online far right.
Yeah,
I think it's kind of like we have to look at this as an own goal on the part of the Democrats.
1,000%.
And I think that was largely, if you go back in the history of this show, that was largely how we responded to 2016. If you remember, you know, the show wasn't around when the 2016 election had first happened. But one of the things that we engaged with a lot in the early episodes was the Russiagate narrative and how that was a security rhetoric that kind of leaked into politics, if that makes sense, where it was a security rhetoric that fundamentally made certain legitimizing arguments on behalf of the Democratic Party establishment.
And importantly, provided cover for them.
And provided cover for them, right? This time, they don't have that security rhetoric to benefit from, which is really interesting.
Yes.
Did you notice that there was no discussion at all after this election or during the election about foreign interference?
Yeah.
I guess all of that just stopped, like Russia, Iran, China, all of these evil countries that are supposedly always interfering in our elections and our political processes just decided, no worries, we're not gonna get involved this time. That's a bit curious, right?
It is, yeah. In the same way that it was also curious that, you know, even though Trump did win, you know, the margin at the end of the day was not wide, or not as wide as it had initially appeared to be. But you still really didn't hear a lot of people on like the Trump right calling foul about election interference. That all seemed to also magically go away from the widespread corruption and election interference of 2020. So, you know.
Yeah, really good point. No, like that's hilarious that they're just like, the Democrats forgot to steal it this time, I guess.
That's right.
You know, the first time it was stop the steal, this time it was forgot to steal.
Forgot to steal.
I don't know. I don't know what happened there.
It's
but I
good.
Think
you should trademark that.
I'm going to. That one might help me in my professional life later. But yeah, I think that, you know, if we look back on our previous episodes that have dealt with the election, we had the VFERB episode where we talked about Tim Walz. And I think, you know, just picking up on what you said about Trump being funny, Tim Walz was really funny when they first brought him out, and then they just stopped using him or told him to be less funny.
Why did
what
you
happened
yes.
there?
Why did you bench Tim Walz? Why did you bench the coach?
Made
he
no
was
sense.
So good.
Made no sense. And I think that our discussion of weirdness and like normalization rhetoric, in particular around like creating or demonizing foreign others as part of your campaign, I think that that's a factor in this election, in the sense that the Democrats did run to the right on foreign policy and immigration policy. And so I think a lot of what we talked about in that regard was relevant. But I also think that our discussion, and this is where we want to go really to focus this episode, our discussion about discourse and manipulation is really relevant here, because one of the key rhetorical situations right now, and this always faces the losing party after an election, is how do you talk to your own side about what went wrong and about what we'll do differently next time, what we need to focus on the next year. It's kind of like after the Pittsburgh Pirates, you know, have another losing season. What does the general manager tell the fan base they're going to do in the offseason to placate the fans and make sure that they still buy their season tickets for next year, despite many, many years consecutively of losing? In this case, you know, what are the Democratic Party bigwigs and choice pundits telling themselves about what the team is going to do differently next time and what went wrong?
To put it in rhetorical terms, it is a moment of epideictic rhetoric. We are in an epideictic moment where the traditional genre in Athenian democracy of praise and blame is what is happening at the level of Democratic Party discourse. And I think larger national discourses as well. What do we blame? How do we assign causality for problems and other issues that we face? And what are the things that we should be paying more attention to or grasping onto moving forward?
Absolutely. And so in our first two episodes in the Discourse and Manipulation series, we were really drawing from scholars from critical discourse studies, people like Toon Van Dyke, Norman Fairclough, Theo Van Leeuwen, this whole school of discourse scholars who have given us really helpful concepts for thinking through the ways that discourse controls cognition fundamentally, that when you use certain discourse structures, you can enact or affect a kind of mind control, right?
Right.
And in this case, I think the thing that has jumped out, not just to us, to lots of commentators on this election and the post-election post-mortems, the thing that has jumped out is silence, the use, and we might even say abuse, of silence in discourse about this election from the Democratic Party's, you know, elected leadership and House pundits and sort of commentator class. And when we say manipulative silence and manipulative absence, I think an example that comes to mind that might help people understand this just to start is the concept of a nominalization. Alex, how do you understand what a nominalization is, just for people who maybe aren't familiar?
Yeah. So the very most basic definition of a nominalization that I usually give my students is a nominalization is a verb or an adjective. So either an action or a description of something that has been turned into a thing or into a noun.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the ones that we've heard a lot in the aftermath of this election that many of our listeners are probably familiar with are even, you know, issue terms like inflation or immigration. You know, the Democrats lost on inflation, immigration. Those would be two very common ones. But there's also these kind of more nuanced and honestly bizarre ones like anti-incumbent sentiment, wokeness,
oh, yes.
messaging.
Oh, yes. Wokeness. That's probably one of my favorite nominalizations of specifically an adjective woke turned into a noun.
Absolutely. Yeah. Wokeness, messaging, these abstractions that what they do is they don't tell us who was doing the thing. They don't tell us what person or group we're actually describing. And as a result, it prevents us from having the actual conversation, the critical conversation that we need to have about those actions and about those actors.
Yeah. And I think just to kind of really even further define nominalizations in the political sense of the things that they occlude are twofold. The first thing that nominalizations are fundamentally kind of obscuring is, just as you said, Calvin, agency, right? The responsibility for an action, right? So when we say something like inflation, right? We get the sense of like, okay, so inflation is a nominalization of the verb to inflate. If our currency is inflating or prices are inflating, whatever it is that is doing the inflation, first of all, that already is being obscured. So the object of that verb is taken away, but also the person who is responsible for that, right? Is it the president who's responsible for that? Is it agribusiness companies who are raising and keeping the prices of groceries high, right? What is exactly actually to blame for that? The second thing that it obscures that I think is also really important is scale, particularly when we're talking about things like wokeness or, you know, like trans identity politics or things like that, where these, you know, basically these things that are hyper-focused on by small groups of the sort of right-wing pundits on the internet can get blown up to, you know, saying that, for example, wokeness is rampant on college campuses when, in fact, many college campuses and just colleges in general are actually quite conservative institutions at a financial level. And it really only might be a handful of very vocal students who are, you know, fitting the very narrow definition, if there is a definition at all, of what these pundits would describe as woke. So the obscuring of both responsibility and scale are the things that I think nominalization does a great job at covering up.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really well put. It also makes me think of the example of crime. Crime is a really powerful nominalization because obviously it completely occludes what kinds of crimes we're talking about, what kinds of criminals, the context surrounding, you know, acts judged to be criminal, and scale. And, you know, when people complain about crime in American cities, they're often not looking at actual policing policy and the ways in which that produces crime as this nominalized thing, policing policy, as well as economic policy and other kinds of policies that produce that.
Right.
So I think we wanted to talk just a little bit, building off of that concept of nominalization, to think about the larger critical discourse studies literature that thinks through absence and silence. So one scholar that we looked to in developing this idea is Norman Fairclough, whose 2003 book, Analyzing Discourse, I'm a big fan of. He talks in Analyzing Discourse about what he calls paradigmatic relations. So these are relations between a text and really what's outside of it or what's absent from it. So he talks about how this applies on many different levels of a text. So it includes grammatical structures like nominalizations, being nouns that are taking on some of the semantic elements of verbs or adjectives. But it also includes things like vocabulary, semantic relations, genres, discourses. So there are all these choices that are made in these texts, for example, about the election, that leave a lot out, right? And so we might say that the style of a text leaves out other possible styles. And at the end of the day, what Fairclough is talking about here is really a fundamental aspect of rhetoric that Kenneth Burke identified, which is, you know, this idea of every way of seeing is also a way of not seeing, that when you create text, you create discourse, you are choosing among possible options, right? And that has profound stakes.
Yeah. And I mean, I see a lot of linkages between Norman Fairclough's concept of paradigmatic relationships and the way that Toon van Dyke talks about manipulation as a form of mind control, right? Because when Van Dyke is talking about mind control, we talked about this a little bit on one of our previous episodes. He's talking not about, you know, literally like hypnotizing somebody or casting a spell over them, but rather giving them mental models to think through the world and the social and political issues that occur within it that, you know, are going to serve the interests of the manipulator, right? Or serve a sort of partial interest. And one of the ways that they do that is by building these paradigmatic relations between words, the actual grammatical structure, the rhetoric of how you talk about something, and the things that they signify out in the world. So if we take a sentence like crime is running rampant in our city or something like that, you have a nominalization there that is probably because of all these paradigmatic relationships that have been built up over time for people that have fear-mongered about, you know, the criminal element of cities specifically being, you know, non-white people who are committing violent crimes or breaking into people's cars, what have you, that are already going to be filling in all of those gaps. That is what I think both Fairclough and Van Dyke are talking about when they talk about the use of things like that. But also, again, that leaves absence the other types of crime that occur in cities. Say, for example, when a healthcare company uses an AI model that has a 90% error rate to deny people their rightful claims to medical care. Is that a crime? Well, the paradigmatic relations have not yet been built up between our associations of crime with those kinds of white collar, quote unquote, actions that actually may constitute a moral ill, but just have not done so at the level of discourse yet.
Right. So when that dog whistle of crime doesn't index, it doesn't paradigmatically invoke those kinds of crimes, like denying healthcare coverage to large numbers of people at scale, things like wage theft, things like, you know, rampant violations of terms of leases by absent landlords.
Yes.
These things that we know go on in cities, but when we say urban crime, we are very clearly not dog whistling towards that. That's fundamentally a result of the paradigmatic relationships that a text builds.
That's right.
And so Toon van Dyke, in his book, Ideology, A Multidisciplinary Approach, talks a little bit about information absencing. There's this concept of the ideological square. So basically that all ideological discourse, which we could say that any political discourse, including the postmortem of an election, is fundamentally ideological. It's building some kind of ideological system. That ideological discourse always does four things. First of all, expresses information that's positive about us, the in-group. It expresses or emphasizes information that's negative about them, the out-group. And then it suppresses information that's positive about them and suppresses information that's negative about us. So basically, make ourselves look maximally good, make our enemy or our other look maximally bad. And I think this is something that we see a lot in these postmortems, in the sense that by avoiding hard conversations around the campaign strategy or the establishment leadership, we avoid talking about negative information about the in-group, about the leader group. And this is a fundamental reason that texts manipulate silence and manipulate absence, is to avoid having those hard conversations and to maintain a kind of ideological purity.
Yeah. And for those of you who might be saying, for example, well, why wouldn't we suppress or de-emphasize information that is negative about us? I mean, again, it depends on the rhetorical situation here. Like, you might not think it politically expedient to say, you know, what goes wrong with your campaign, like while the campaign is being run, but in a moment of apodictic reflection, something like that might actually be warranted, and actually showing a little humility towards your own tactics of saying, well, what can we honestly say may have gone well and what went wrong? What did we do that may have influenced this negative outcome? I think is perfectly called for in a circumstance like this. And so the ideological square is a nice way of saying that it's not just about making ourselves look maximally good, but also suppressing anything that might make us look bad.
Right. And which shows like fundamentally a lack of self-critique and a lack of will to get better. When this discourse is fundamentally ideological, it's more about maintaining a power structure than it is about progressing or shifting power in ways that might in the long run expand your power, depending on how you affect that change, right? And so it makes me think a lot about the ways in which the Harris campaign refused to really break from Joe Biden, who was a historically unpopular president. Like, I haven't looked that closely at the numbers, so I can't say this with 100% certainty, but I believe it's like George Bush after the Iraq war levels, like of approval rating, like that low.
As of right now, where we stand, Joe Biden, according to 538, stands at a 37.8% approval rating and a 55.7% disapproval rating, with a differential of 17.9% in the disapproval column.
Yeah. So, you know, when that is very rightly perceived as part of your us, your in-group, it might make sense to not suppress some negative information about that in order to potentially break from, or at least show a plan to, you know, improve the power center here. And so I think that really worked at cross purposes of the campaign. Now, moving from ideology, another very interesting piece on textual silence comes from Thomas Huckin from his 2002 article. And what's really cool about the way that Huckin approaches silence, first of all, my mind was really blown when I revisited this article, because Huckin's primary example is actually local news commentary in Seattle about homelessness.
Yeah, which is very still relevant to you.
Yeah, very relevant, and like still incredibly relevant. And he's looking at these editorials about homelessness and basically trying to figure out what is the prevailing stock of relevant knowledge or opinion that was presumably available to the writer, and then what is missing. So that's kind of the method that he follows for looking at silence. Really, he's asking the question, what could have been said yet wasn't? And so we were just talking about an example of that. Harris could have said all these things about what Biden was doing wrong, how Biden was, you know, being completely outplayed by Netanyahu on Middle Eastern politics, or how Biden didn't do enough to rein in price gouging on the part of corporations, whatever it might have been. That was absolutely relevant knowledge and opinion that was available to Harris that she chose not to engage with. And then Huckin further asks questions such as, quote, how is it in the writer's interest to deliberately mislead the reader? And so we can talk about that, as well as, you know, drawing attention to the layers of organizational power that weigh on a writer or a politician's decision making about what to include and what not to include. And obviously, there are layers of organizational power here that play into this.
Yeah, I think that's really what Huckin brings to this analysis that is most useful for, again, thinking about reviving a rhetorical critique in the wake of an election where we see one candidate using what seems to be just kind of inartful rhetoric. Yes. Is that what are the layers of organizational power that are maybe staying the hand of the other side? Because again, like you said, I think it's better to read this as an own goal on the part of Democrats. And I think as we get into looking at some texts that help us pick apart these silences, I think we're going to uncover some reasons why those layers of organizational power might suppress the saying of certain things.
Absolutely. Now, just one more piece that I wanted to share from the discourse studies literature is Toon Van Dyke, in that same text on ideology, talks about, how he conceives of this idea of common sense. And I think this is something that's come up a lot in these postmortems, is just, you know, the Democrats were out of touch with common sense, but somehow Donald Trump spoke to the common sense of the common man. And so Van Dyke has a really interesting theory of what common sense is and what that concept means in discourse. He says that common sense, quote, connotes that such knowledge is direct, immediate, unreflected, untheoretical, and unscientific, but based on or derived from everyday observation or experiences, unquote. He goes on to say that, quote, common sense is also associated, at least implicitly, with popular or lower class cognition as what common people think and find. And so it's, as he says, taken for granted knowledge. And so things like they take away our jobs, that's an example that he gives. But a common sense argument is an argument based on a common sense model. And the same is true for common sense descriptions, accounts, and explanations. There he writes, quote, such accounts are typically founded on what we all know or what everybody says.
Yeah.
And I think this is a really interesting idea that plays out in a lot of these postmortems.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of information that seems to be sort of like, well, we all know that this was an issue, and so therefore, let's move on to this next, you know, if you think about it in the terms of like stasis theory, for example, or kind of synthesize common sense with stasis theory, Toon Van Dyke's common sense is a way of saying, well, some of these earlier stasis categories, like what caused this problem in the first place? How should we define it? What are the facts that are relevant at hand are all to be taken for granted. We can hand wave them away and move on to these more sort of weighty decisions about how should we evaluate something? What should we do about it? Because we can just take for granted that everybody already believes these other things, even though that conveniently allows you to not talk about them. And I think that's really what's useful about bringing a term like common sense in here and why exactly. We're referencing it again.
Exactly. And I think just to tie us back to how we started this discussion of the literature, I think often, especially when grammatical structures like nominalizations are used, common sense is sort of hiding behind the invocation of that nominalization. Something like inflation or crime or even wokeness is usually hiding a supposed common sense understanding of what those terms mean. Like, we all agree on it. We all know what ordinary folks think is going on in their communities, and we need to speak to that instead of debating, as you said, those very factual definitional questions. We just sort of assume a definition and a set of facts.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think that, I mean, if we can move on to our analysis now, we brought in a series of texts here, starting with one that I think actually really nicely exemplifies right at the very beginning, this notion of common sense synthesized with our understanding of nominalizations and how we can sort of, you know, you can create a very complex argument that is stated in very concise terms. So the first text that I'm going to bring in here is from a longtime New York Times columnist, Maureen Dowd. She wrote an op-ed just after the election called Democrats and the Case of Mistaken Identity Politics. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about this is because it's gone a little bit under-discussed, I think, in other podcasts and other media that has been sort of analyzing the reactions and the post-morta to this election. But this one specifically was read on air by the co-hosts of MSNBC's Morning Joe, the Mika Brzezinski and the coffee man himself, Joe Scarborough. And they seemed to take it quite seriously as they were reading it through. In fact, Mika made a point of repeating this very first line here.
Wow.
Here it goes. Some Democrats are finally waking up and realizing that woke is broke. So here we not only have the nominalization woke, which again is being used as a noun, I think, because it's something that used to be used as a description, but is now given another descriptor, which is broke. And it's also being framed as common sense. We are waking up and we are realizing this thing that everybody else, again, ostensibly already knew, which is that woke is broke. What did you make of this?
There's so many layers here, because I'm now realizing that to wake is a verb, and it was a verb transformed into an adjective. And it was originally actually a positive term used by, you know, Black activists and Black commentators to talk about like people who have done the research and are aware of history and politics and theory that informs their lives and informs the kind of challenges that they're facing in living in an unequal society, right?
Right.
And so that was the original meaning of woke. It was taking something that was quite active, like to wake up, and transforming that into an adjective in order to describe someone who is really sort of like hyper aware of the unequal society they live in. But now that's been transformed even further into a noun. And I believe like before Maureen Dowd, I was more aware of like Ron DeSantis was someone who really used woke, not even wokeness, but like just woke
right.
as a noun. Like we must stop woke.
Woke is a form of cultural Marxism. Woke needs to die.
Isn't, I believe that was actually even a Florida law that he passed was like the Stop Woke Act.
Yes.
And I think woke was some kind of acronym, W-O-K-E. No memory at all of what that stood for. And so, yeah, we have this incredibly complex nominalization work being done with the word woke.
Yeah. Right now, our friend and loyal listener, Cameron Mozafari, is probably screaming and throwing his hands up in the air because he's actually done some really interesting work on the word yes. woke, and specifically the way that it's been transformed into kind of this blunt nominal signifier. So we'll link to some of Cameron's threads at the very least, if not some of the publicly available work that he's done on this. So continuing on with Dowd's thread. Donald Trump won a majority of white women and remarkable numbers of black and Latino voters and young men. Democratic insiders thought people would vote for Kamala Harris, even if they didn't like her, to get rid of Trump. But more people ended up voting for Trump, even though many didn't like him, because they liked the Democratic Party less. It goes on here, after a couple of sentences. The party embraced a worldview of hyper-political correctness, condescension, and cancellation, and it supported diversity statements for job applicants and faculty lounge terminology like Latinx and BIPOC, which stands for Black Indigenous People of Color. This alienated half the country or more, and the chaos and anti-Semitism at many college campuses certainly didn't help. I want to pause there. Just so we can, did you count how many nominalizations we had in there, Calvin?
It's crazy. It's crazy. Hyper political correctness, condescension, cancellation. Yeah. I mean, look, so much of this is just, you know, unsupported conjecture and assumption. I have no idea actually what she's talking about in the sense of supporting diversity statements for job applicants. Is that about the Democratic Party itself?
Like, that's the thing. That's only something
that's not a policy.
That only happens on college campuses, and most don't even do that anymore. Like
Right. No, and faculty lounge terminology like Latinx and BIPOC, no examples given. No examples given. You know, we can be accused of a lot of things on this show, but we at least always have examples
yes.
to back up what we talk about.
Right.
And this is such cheap argumentation when you don't even give an example. I mean, I think people have pointed out like the last time a politician used Latinx was like 2020 or earlier.
Yeah. They don't do it anymore.
They don't do it anymore because they got these same critiques when they first used it. And, you know, a lot of this stuff is just so superficial. Right. And so of course we didn't even talk about yet the nominalizations of, you know, anti-Semitism at college campuses, how that smuggles in a common sense assumption that we all know what we're talking about when we
That's
refer
right.
to that. And yeah, I mean, there's just so much built into this that is unsourced and unsupported.
Yeah, I think nominalizations doing one of the functions that I described earlier of obscuring scale specifically with
yes.
the first three, hyper-political correctness, condescension, and cancellation are all things that happen to people in the media and in academia.
Yep.
Really isn't felt at the level of anything else unless you're talking about like, I don't know, like your son, daughter, nephew, niece comes home from college and, you know, he talks about what they're learning in class and, you know, you as a conservative feel triggered by it or, you know, or you're yep. feeling like, oh, well, I'm being alienated by all this fancy Dan language that they're throwing around. And again, that's just like, that's so immaterial to the actual politics of this country that putting it on the same level as like, you know, well, this is why they lost the election is, I think, I mean, it's reducing an already overdetermined political event into something that is just so laughably superficial that I don't know why anybody takes arguments like this seriously. But yeah, I also just want to mention specifically about the quote unquote chaos and anti-Semitism at many college campuses, which is, of course, referring to the pro-Palestinian anti-genocide protests that are happening on a lot of college campuses. I'm using that terminology because that is what Amnesty International is now calling Israel's war in Gaza, and also what the International Court of Justice has said Israel's actions in Gaza likely constitutes a genocide. And of course, the ICC has called for arrest warrants for Yoav Gallant and Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as leaders of Hamas for crimes against humanity. So at any rate, reducing all of that to anti-Semitism on college campuses, I think occludes the very real anti-Semitism that does have a root in American society. There are people who, you know, are literally, you know, are fundamentally antagonistic to Jewish people as like an ethnic class of humanity. And that's not who the college campus protesters are. Nope. And to put those on the same level reduces the seriousness of that term. I fundamentally think it does real violence to Jewish people. I mean, I have no place to say so, not being Jewish myself, but to me, it feels like a way of making it far less serious than it actually needs to be.
Absolutely. And the point is that, you know, when you make a choice to invoke a loaded nominalization like that, you just simply put actual human action outside of the reach of debate and examination and critique. And so that's the real problem with invoking a nominalization like that, in my opinion. I mean, of course, it does that political damage that you're describing. But before we even get there, we can't even sort of locate what we should be debating and critiquing, because you're just sort of sweeping it all under this brush of this abstract nominalization.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm going to go on a little further in this article here. She continues, "One thing that makes Democrats great is that they unabashedly support groups that have suffered from inequality, but they have to begin avoiding extreme policies that alienate many Americans who would otherwise be drawn to the party. Democrats learned the hard way in this election that mothers care both about abortion rights and having their daughters compete fairly and safely on the playing field." So that's a little bit of a loaded statement there. Calvin, any idea what Maureen Dowd is talking about in that particular instance?
Yeah, I mean, this is about, you know, trans people competing in sports in public schools, but it's completely, again, completely unclear what Maureen Dowd's position on it is and what specific examples we're looking at. This is, you know, largely been brought up in the context of one particular interview that Kamala Harris gave back in like 2020, in which she voiced support for, you know, some sort of pro-trans policy.
"When I was attorney general, I learned that the California Department of Corrections, which was a client of mine, I didn't get to choose my client, that they were standing in the way of surgery.
For prisoners.
For prisoners. And there was a specific case. And when I learned about the case, I worked behind the scenes to not only make sure that that transgender woman got the services she was deserving, I made sure that they changed the policy in the state of California so that every transgender inmate in the prison system would have access to the medical care that they desired and need."
But we're kind of having this debate 4 or 5 layers deep in meta level commentary about that one quote that Kamala Harris gave. And there's this assumption. One of the crazy things that Maureen Dowd does in this article is contracts the space between supposed woke rhetoric and policy. Right. So if you notice in that one of the lines that you read, they have to begin avoiding extreme policies that blah, 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 blah. Right. What are the policies, though?
That's like, there was no policy. There was no
trans policy platform that was like really heavily highlighted in this campaign. Right.
Yeah.
And so we seem to be talking about complete phantoms.
Yes. No, you're exactly right. And again, using a nominalization like that allows for that kind of conceptual slippage that we assume that because she talks about abortion rights, and yes, that is a policy issue. There were policies that, you know, again, yeah, federal rights to an abortion were stripped away actually under the Biden administration, not by the Biden administration, but by the Supreme Court on his watch. And yeah, the transgender people competing in athletics had nothing to do with federal level politics at any way, probably largely because it affects like 0.1% of the population. I mean, it's like, it's just not a sizable enough, again, this is an obfuscation of scale. It's not a sizable enough issue. Like, I mean, is it a worthy issue at some level? Yes, of course it is. But like, is it a sizable enough issue to be talked about seriously in a conversation about what won or lost an election? That, if you think about it for like 2 seconds, should be completely laughable.
Yeah. And it's, yeah, to say that it's determinative. I mean, in order to say that, you need to really get into the broader media ecosystem that these elections occur within. And that requires talking through material forces that shape the media that people receive. If transphobia, you know, tipped the election towards Trump, that's a result of the large scale outsourcing of news and politics and sort of like public sphere commentary to algorithms that serve more and more right wing content to people, right? Like that are,
yes,
that are built by particular people at tech companies to make money for their shareholders, right?
Yes.
Maureen Dowd is not examining that. She's just sort of assuming that because a lot of people are talking about this, you know, one successful campaign commercial that the Trump campaign ran in which Kamala Harris said some controversial things about trans rights, that that equals a policy platform for trans people, which we simply have not seen.
No. That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, again, if she really had any honesty here, any kind of journalistic integrity, you know, might be a little bit more careful there, but maybe that's too much to expect. I don't know. At any rate, I really wanted to land on this one point because I think this is where the, you know, the broken clock of Maureen Dowd is right at least once today. Kamala, a Democratic lawmaker, told me, made the quote, unquote, colossal mistake of running a billion-dollar campaign with celebrities like Beyonce when many of the struggling working-class voters she wanted couldn't even afford a ticket to a Beyonce concert, much less a down payment on a home. Quote, I don't think the average person said, Kamala Harris gets what I'm going through, end quote, this Democrat said. So that's one point where it feels like she might have actually stumbled across something that might be somewhat worthwhile and worth talking about, which is that if people feel like this is a party of opulence, of people who are, you know, one with celebrities or people who are at an echelon that is just outside of what working class or, you know, ordinary people are going through, then that feels a little bit more on the nose, right? That might invoke people's sense of economic insecurity and get them to feel like maybe this person doesn't really represent my interests.
Right. And I think that this gets at one of the fundamental problems I have with this dichotomy that's set up between, you know, quote unquote, woke elite Democrats on the one hand and like in touch, common sense, working class Republicans on the other. There's nothing economic about that dichotomy. And yet, economics are often invoked to explain what people are actually going through. And so you have to ask the question, what are the actual economics and financial interests and material interests of the leadership of the Democratic Party? We never ask that. We only sort of these rhetorical side effects, like trying to sound quote unquote woke. But never, where do they go to work when they leave the Democratic Party? Oh, they go to Uber and they go to Microsoft and these massive corporations, Goldman Sachs. Maybe that's more the dichotomy that we need to be looking into as opposed to these kind of superficial surface level issues of things they said 4 years ago that they've never said again. And so, yeah, I that's really where I'm left kind of baffled by these arguments, because the two things are not at all related to each other. Right.
Oh, I think you're absolutely spot on. And it's why, you know, analyzing silence through this is kind of, you know, tricky, because when they do let something that actually feels real and feels relevant, something that otherwise goes completely uncommented upon, just the fact that most people, most ordinary working class people can't afford a down payment on a home. Like, why is that not like A1, but, you know, headline of every right. national newspaper every day, that like, oh yeah, most people like can't afford livable lives in America, the supposedly wealthiest country in the world. It becomes just kind of a footnote that's used as the denominator for this equation of like, well, it was woke over economics. And so therefore, you know, the two just, you know, they focused too much on the woke. They didn't go enough into the economics, and you know, that's why they lost. And sort of it, like you said, occludes the broader analysis of why they may not be paying attention to some of those economic issues, because it runs against their class interests.
Absolutely. And then, I mean, there's also the issue of lack of evidence that they actually are woke.
Yes. Like, yeah. That's also true.
They're even using woke rhetoric. I mean, we talked about this when it was happening. The Harris campaign was incredibly centrist. It was incredibly anti-woke. It was incredibly trying to appeal to like middle of the road American patriotism and nationalism and, you know, pro American troops rhetoric.
Yes.
If that's now woke, I mean, that's news to me. That would be actually pretty awesome if it gave us a way to like reduce militarism. We have a new critique with which to express anti-militarism. Cool. But like, I don't think most people are thinking about that when they're thinking about woke.
Yeah. Probably when they're thinking about woke. I love that we've just embraced that nominalization now. When we're thinking, I often think about woke.
Yeah.
My thoughts return to woke several times a day.
It's the first thing I think about when I wake up.
Last thing when I go to bed. I want to skip down to the next argument here, just for the sake of time, because I think we spend a deserving amount of time on that Maureen Dowd piece. But I'll read through the full one of this next text, because I think it represents, again, another way of kind of, you know, diverting our attention away from some of the things that we could be talking about to other things that might be easy distractions at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a statement that was released by the National Organization for Women, one of the organizations that early first wave feminists like Betty Friedan founded. They released a post-election statement called "Racism, Sexism, Misogyny, and Hate Won This Election, But We Won't Let Our Democracy Be Destroyed." So this is by Christian F. Nunez, the national NOW president. "Donald Trump won by activating a base of voters who chose his racism, misogyny, and xenophobia over unity and democracy. Kamala Harris wanted to turn the page on Trump, while Trump ran on turning back the clock on equal access to rights we've been fighting for the last 100 years. Kamala Harris's campaign didn't fail. Voters failed Harris. This result was not a reflection of her ability to lead, but voters' ability to trust women. For the second time, the most qualified and experienced candidate for president has been defeated because she is a woman. This can't happen again. Where do we go from here? While we might feel a mix of uncomfortable emotions and want to retreat, it's important that we pause and think about what just happened, grieve, and then ask questions about what it will take for us to disrupt the persistence of structural inequalities so that our elections never repeat these same destructive patterns." So that's the excerpt. Calvin, I don't know, what was your reaction? What did you notice there?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I'll say is that I have definitely heard this reaction the most from colleagues and friends who I absolutely respect. And I think there's something to this reaction. You know, this was undoubtedly a factor. I think what's interesting here rhetorically is what we could point out in terms of silences, absences, and nominalizations, right? So there's this idea that voters chose racism, misogyny, and xenophobia over unity and democracy. I mean, these are, we could call them nominalizations. Some of them are nominalizations, but they're also ideographs,
yes,
which is a concept that we've talked about a lot on this show. Basically, you know, the positive ideographs of unity and democracy were defeated by these negative ideographs of racism, misogyny, and xenophobia. And I think that that reading ignores the fact that many, many millions of voters were not thinking about those things when they made their choice, right?
Right.
It's simply impossible to imagine that they were, because obviously discourse primes, you know, Toon Van Dyke shows us how discourse primes cognition in particular ways. And while Trump did run on a lot of, you know, retrograde attitudes and ideologies like these things, and he had that horrendous Madison Square Garden rally shortly before the election, the thing is that there are many, many other discourses that overdetermine how people are thinking when they enter the voting booth. And there was also a massive discourse around just how inept and ineffective Joe Biden had been. And
yes,
the fact that Harris had been his vice president with a great deal of power in that administration, and people were unhappy with the administration. People were unhappy with the decisions that they made on economics, on foreign policy, on a whole host of issues, right? And so obviously when you have lines later in the excerpt that you read, like the most qualified and experienced candidate for president, that is ignoring the many problems with the administration that Harris had just been working for, indeed is still working for. And so those absences really stand out here. There's also just the statement, voters failed Harris. I mean, that feels like such a reversal of power when many of those voters are women, right? Many of,
yes,
those voters are working class people and people who have so much less power than Harris. I mean, Harris is a rich, wealthy, powerful politician with ties to corporations, with ties to, you know, the absolute centers of power. And so to blame powerless voters instead of this extremely powerful politician is certainly a choice, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, again, I recognize my own, you know, discomfort coming at this as a man and, you know, not,
right,
trying to, you know, over explain this here, but like, but I fundamentally, I think anyone can see that there is a clear power differential here in saying that, well, it's actually the problem of all the voters and not the person who ran the campaign. I think whether you're running a man or a woman for president, it is always incumbent upon the candidate to make a good case to the voters and not, you know, blame the voters for failing, you know, in some moral sense. But it's also, I think, the other issue with this line of reasoning is that it's just fundamentally a defeatist position. You know,
right,
if you're saying that, you know, it's our voters are failures, they're unable to trust women, and, you know, that's the only real reason that she was defeated is because she's a woman. Well, what hope do we ever have of electing a woman president if you actually buy into that line of thinking? Like, it is, mm-hmm, just a dead end argument at the end of the day. And I call it an article of faith, but I have a little bit more hope than that, that, you know, American people could actually vote for a woman for president if they actually represented their interests well.
Yeah. And it comes back to the ways in which all of these theories of discourse and manipulation that we're talking about involve agency and invoke,
yes,
the idea of agency.
Yes.
So what these silences do is they ignore all the ways in which people could have been activated. People could have been activated to, as the part you just read says, quote, disrupt the persistence of structural inequalities,
yeah,
right? I mean, that phrase, the persistence of structural inequalities, it is so totalizing and terrifying and depressing, right?
Yeah.
But people could have been activated. I mean, look at the college campuses. Obviously, Maureen Dowd is not a great fan, but like earlier in the year, we had massive civil unrest and disobedience fighting for peace on college campuses. And that was a groundswell of activation and movement that, you know, could have been channeled in various ways. It was completely,
yes,
ignored by this campaign. And by the way, that, you know, that activism largely run by women, largely run by like people of a variety of identities and gender performativities. And so, right, like there was action, there was agency in the political system at the same time as these campaigns were going on. Mm-hmm. But was it involved? Was it invoked? Or was it silenced? Like, as yeah. we can see that all of these rhetorical techniques do. And I think that's really what disturbs me about an argument like this. It's not that I don't see where it's coming from, but it's the way in which it does kind of assume the impossibility of agency or such like such constraints on agency that we simply couldn't have produced a different outcome if we had acted differently.
Yeah, that's a pretty major erasure is the idea that, well, there was nothing we possibly could have done. Well, speaking of defeatist arguments, so yet again, as you'll remember, we analyzed the appearance of one Alex Garland on Pod Save America and his kind of glib takes on the political situation in America. We've got another guest on Pod Save America. This David Plouffe, who worked specifically for the Kamala Harris campaign, was one of the main people in charge of steering that campaign, among others who appeared on the podcast. But this is just an excerpt from that conversation that I think is quite revealing of how they themselves are reflecting epideictically on the challenge as well as the opportunity that they could not seize. Here he is. We were in a challenging political environment where to get to 50% of the vote in enough states to win 270 electoral votes, we needed some percentage of Republicans. But I think what people forget is it's more of independents who act like Republicans, where issues of democracy, of how unhinged he, referring to Trump, is. Project 2025 mattered to them, even as some conservative Democrats. Also, when you're being attacked as being a crazy, out-of-touch California liberal, when you have generals and former Republican elected officials saying, "I'm for Kamala Harris," that helps rebut that. In many respects, that'll be more effective than what she would say herself. And then as it relates to, the comments about, wanting generals like Hitler, that's again referring to something Trump said, that mm-hmm. bothered voters, okay? So yeah, we could have decided to just ignore that, the comments from Trump, and say, mm-hmm. and just say, let's talk about tax cuts today. I don't think that would have advanced the ball with the people that we needed to advance it with. And again, I just want to, again, it can sound like making excuses. This political environment sucked, okay? We were dealing with ferocious headwinds, and I think people's instinct was to give the Republicans and even Donald Trump another chance. So we had a complicated puzzle to put together here in terms of the voters. And it was going to take a little bit more independent Republicans than we saw in 2020. Sorry. Maybe 1% more Republican voters for us. It was going to take voters saying, quote, "Even though I judge Trump's first term favorably, I'm more concerned about him this time," end quote.
Yeah. So, I mean, this idea of political environment and headwinds and a complicated puzzle, right? All of that is the result of your own action. So this yes. is the agency that's being included here is
yes.
the strategy that the Democratic Party has been running on for, damn near 30 years at this point, going back to the 90s. I mean, triangulation was a strategy, not to use a nominalization, triangulation, which was this idea that Bill Clinton would run to the right. In fact, in the early 90s, when Bill Clinton was coming up as a kind of populist outsider candidate in the Democratic Party, what made him a populist and an outsider was actually that he wanted to run to the right on certain issues. And so that was his way of challenging the establishment at that time. And then basically 30, 40 years later, we're now in a situation where the establishment is the establishment of Clinton. And David Plouffe and, yes. and Joe Biden, right? And mm-hmm. so now the establishment has adopted wholesale all of the right-wing policy positions that Bill Clinton wanted them to adopt. At that time, he was coming as an outsider. But that political environment is determined yes. by one of the two major political parties and by their presidencies, by the policies and like ultimate legacy of Barack Obama for 8 years, mm-hmm. by the campaign that Hillary Clinton ran in 2016. All of these political decisions that go into leading once you're in office and running when you're a major like billion-dollar campaign, those decisions have long-term effects and they produce what we're calling a political environment. It's not natural. It's a result right. of human actions.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's important to note that these are not just nominalizations or nouns. They are also
metaphors.
They're also conceptual metaphors that, yeah. again, conceptual metaphors are key in creating the kind of mental representations that, you know, is what Toon Van Dyke calls mind control, that we can just talk about as like providing a mental map for understanding the terrain here, right? That the political environment is something that, when we think about the environment, that's not something that human beings can control. Ferocious headwinds are not something that you can control. Complicated puzzles are things to be solved fundamentally, but you know, it's hard, right?
Yeah.
These are, it's like saying, actually, you know, the real reality would be like, we are the ones who manufactured the puzzle and we're having right. trouble putting it back together now that we've taken it apart. It just
you
doesn't.
Made your own puzzle by, yes. for example, coming up with this gotcha immigration bill that they presented to the Republicans on a silver platter, only so that to like trick the Republicans into voting against it, so they could make a bizarre hypocrisy argument that like we wanted to do a hardcore anti-immigration bill, but you voted against it, so you're not actually anti-immigrant. We are anti-immigrant. Well, apparently voters decided that they would vote for, you know, the less anti-immigrant party, I guess, according to your rhetoric, even though we know that Donald Trump ferociously hates immigrants.
And has promised mass deportations. It just, yeah, it's really fascinating to have him lead off using the noun democracy with this whole thing, because I think that this has been one of the, as it turns out, unfortunately, one of the biggest canards in Democratic politics over the course of the last 8 years is talking
Absolutely.
About the preservation of democracy, when all that has happened over the last 8 years under both a Republican and a Democratic administration is a very clear erosion of democratic, not only norms, but also rights and other yeah. things that are very clearly be like free speech is being very clearly chipped away by, you know, by all sorts of different legislation, but not the least of which, you know, taking up a definition of anti-Semitism that would allow, at this point, the Trump administration to basically shutter any nonprofit, revoke their status of any nonprofit that it deems to be critical of a nation state like Israel. It's just a joke. It doesn't feel real at this point anymore.
And it's a real shame, because I actually think that, you know, if they wanted to, they could run hard, you know, if they had the consistent policy, they could run hard against the Republicans on democracy, because
yes.
we know that Republicans have been trying to restrict voting rights and do all these things that like reduce nominal liberal democracy. We know that Republicans are anti-free speech. They want to ban books from libraries and they want to reduce our ability to talk about, yeah, like important foreign policy issues. And they did January 6th, like for whatever skepticism or, you know, reaction to the reaction to January 6th that people might have, that it was overblown by the Democrats or it was exploited by the Democrats. Fundamentally, it was an anti-democratic action. And so
Absolutely.
you had that on a silver platter as sort of like the paradigm case of this anti-democratic strain in the Republican Party. If you wanted to run on that, you could have put together a very clear and cogent set of arguments towards that strategy, but it simply wasn't done because of this, again, pardon the nominalization, triangulation strategy that has been the bread and butter of the Democratic Party since the 90s, run to the right to try to chip away at these Republican voters. And I did just quickly want to point out that I love that Plouffe says, so yeah, we could have decided to ignore that and just say, let's talk about tax cuts today. This reminds me of the Maureen Dowd piece, in that the only alternative they can imagine is
another Republican policy.
Is another Republican policy. Is instead of using woke rhetoric, doing Republican policy. But like, what about Democratic policy? What about like the legacy of FDR? Why are they so scared of that
yeah.
nowadays?
That's the thing. It's like, you know, I'm not trying to sound like somebody who's like, well, yeah, they should have done a better job messaging the good things that they did. But like, if they had
done better things,
they should have fundamentally done better things. But like, there were clear examples of people in the leadership, like Lina Khan at the FTC, who's been
absolutely
very, very consistent in doing things that are not abstract policies, doing things like saying that it should be just as easy to cancel a service as it is to opt into or to subscribe to a service. Like, that's genuinely going to affect many, many people in very real ways. And it provides a great example of how, like, government and, you know, politics can actually touch people's lives in positive ways. Like, I mean, if you're not learning from examples like that, of like, that is popular, that wins things. If you do things like that, you will win elections. And I mean, the cynic in me is the one who's at the end of the day saying, I mean, not, I don't know if they want to win, but it's like, is there the interests of the people who they really represent, the donor class, or, you know, other people who have a stake in the Democratic Party and their lawmakers in power, are they eliding these things for strategic reasons because of what Thomas Hucken would call the layers of organizational power that are basically suppressing speech that would help you win? I mean, that's the fundamentally the, you know, if we continue with the sports metaphor of this election being an own goal on the Democrats' part, it's really, you know, one has to question, is the coach betting against the team? You know, like, is the coach betting against the team? Because I fundamentally don't know.
Well, and, you know, and that's the structural layer here that is unavoidable. And it's to come back to something we talked about in our rambling intro to this episode, like, that's been one of the major ways that I've processed this election result, is thinking through the structural factors that make it such that Democrats don't need to win to make money, right?
Right.
The Democratic Party is fundamentally a corporate institution. And when we say that, it's not a metaphor. Like, it's it actually has an entire structure that generates massive amounts of income for leadership classes within it. They contract with a ton of outside contractors, consultancies, groups that do data analytics and do this kind of wonky messaging advice. Your choice is between tax cuts and being woke. Like, those are your two choices. All of these entities that produce terrible advice like that make millions of dollars in every election. And so that entire structure informs the ways that they talk about elections and that they talk about political events. And it helps them to use these nominalizations and these other techniques of textual silencing, because it prevents scrutiny and critique of their own decisions and their own material interests.
Yeah. No, and I mean, that I think is something that people are at the very least less afraid to acknowledge now than they were back in 2016. You know, I mean, if we are coming to a close here, kind of reflecting on, you know, what is different moving forward from this Trump victory versus the 2016 Trump victory. I mean, at the very least, I think, I guess this is more of an article of faith, a hope, is that people are a little bit more willing to acknowledge these kind of contradictions at the heart of Democratic Party politics. And whether that means the emergence of third parties to challenge it, or, you know, some sort of like insurgent change from the inside is going to fundamentally shake the foundations here. I mean, I think you can't ignore it anymore. And it's becoming harder and harder to keep up that omerta, that vow of silence that we never talk about how the Democratic Party is funded and how that might be at odds with their progressive messaging.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, for me, the big takeaway from all of this is we need to remain woke to these instances of manipulative silence. Like, look for them. Look for them in these kinds of conversations, and don't be afraid to be the pain in the ass who raises the volume, who fills that silence with, like, what is missing? What are we not addressing? What are we not talking about? Because that's exactly where the agency is. It's inevitably someone was oppressed, someone was ignored, someone was silenced who could have really made a powerful difference in politics. And there is action, there is activity, there is organizing, there is agency, but maybe it's not in these sort of corporate boardrooms where Democratic Party strategy and Democratic Party postmortems are written.
Yeah, it's still the kind of thing that, you know, practice it at local levels. Like your boss will use lots of nominalizations in statements to the workforce. Your college administrator will use tons of nominalizations that oftentimes don't mean anything in their rhetoric. And yes, no matter your position in that, you always have ways to call that out, to question what you're being told and to help fill in those silences with what they actually mean. Because at the very least, then we can start having an honest conversation.
Absolutely. So shout out Thomas Hucken.
Yes,
read the Thomas Hucken piece. We're going to have all of the lit that we've been citing in this episode listed in the show description. And, you know, I think Discourse and Manipulation is going to be maybe a forever series on Reverb.
We might have to keep coming back to it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like kind of impossible to avoid these techniques. And there's just such a rich well of threshold concepts that can help us from the literature and CDS about these topics. So
it's true. And it's a good reminder that, you know, you listener are not alone in this. You know, we're all trying to muddle through this together, both at the level of discourse and at the level of action, and how those two speak to each other, I think is very important. So we'll be staying with it. And we hope that you'll be staying with us as well through all of it.
Absolutely. And just stay woke, you know,
stay woke.
When you're awake, you should be woke. When you go to sleep, woke.
I'm woke when I'm awake. I'm woke when I'm asleep. I'm woke in the shower. I'm woke when I'm eating breakfast.
We're bringing it back. I'm going to bring it back. I'm going to fully embrace being a woke professor.
I am dyeing my hair blue as we speak. I've got the little tin foil in my hair right now, and I'm going to work, and I'm going to.
I'm saying my pronouns, baby.
I'm saying my pronouns all
pronouns
I'm,
are in my
people,
bio.
People who know me, I'm always saying my pronouns. I'm always saying pronouns.
Same here. By the way, check out our episode on pronouns.
Yes, check out our episode on pronouns. That's also very good. We're very proud of it.
Well, from all of us here at Reverb, we have lots more content coming to you in 2025. Project 2025, our project is going to be to deliver more content to you. But look, it's been a tough year, I think, for everyone. But we're with you in solidarity, and we can't wait to speak with you soon. Bye-bye.
Absolutely. Bye-bye, everybody.
Our show today was produced by Alex Helberg and Calvin Pollock, with editing work by Alex. Reverb's co-producers at large are Ben Williams, Sophie Wadzak, and Olivia Burnett. You can subscribe to Reverb and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Android, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Check out our website at www.reverbcast.com. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ReverbCast. That's REVERB_CAST. If you've enjoyed our show and want to help amplify more of our public scholarship work, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice, and tell a friend about us. We sincerely appreciate the support of our listeners. Thanks so much for tuning in.